drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Minnie Woolsey was a star of sideshows across the US during the early 20th century, performing under the name Cuckoo the Bird Girl. You may know of her if you've seen the 1930s movie Freaks, but if not, Sarah Hubolt wants to introduce you to her story. Sarah herself is a circus performer, an academic, and she's represented Australia at the Paralympics. And in her latest show, she's talking on the persona of Cuckoo. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Who is Cuckoo?
That's a very good question and a hashtag. Cuckoo is a circus sideshow performer that did star in the Freaks movie. She had a rare condition, and so she grew up in the asylums because a lot of people with disability used to be in the asylums. And then she was discovered by a circus performer and toured all around America. And then she did the film, and then she ended up in Coney Island. So essentially she's a working actor. Mm. You know, she's one of my forerunners in terms of performers and in terms of circus history. So she's a rare bird, rare individual. And that's all I know about her, really.
Why is she important to you, though? Why build a whole show around her?
Yeah. So her story is a little bit mysterious, and I was very intrigued when I was researching the Freak shows. And the reason why she's important to me is because we have a very uncanny resemblance. And so I'm the only person really in the world that can tell her story. We look quite visually similar. And I've gone through my whole lifetime not knowing anybody like me. So that's quite emotional for me, and quite a labour of love making this show, to think that someone born 100 years before me who looks really, really similar, like it's quite spooky, and then had this really interesting history around the social context around disability at the time and around wanting to be a performer, and it's a similar journey in my lifetime. So it was a perfect character for me to build a show around.
When did you discover her? Because you say it was like very emotional for you, and yeah. I completely get what you mean by that, the idea of, you know, finding someone you could identify with that looked like you. But when did that happen for you?
I began to do performance in 2006, and I trained at Volcano Women's Circus, and I learnt contemporary circus skills. And then one of the other women there said to me a few years later, hey, there was this bird girl in history, you should look her up. And I forgot about it. I tucked it in the back of my mind. Then I kept doing my arts practice, and I found that I could get certain roles and then I couldn't get other roles because of the way that I looked. So we're still trying to challenge diversity on stage and screen here in Australia and globally to have, you know, a really diverse media out there. And then when I came across a few barriers and I was like, man, what do I do next with my career? I thought, oh, you know what, I'm gonna look up that bird girl. I'm going to look up this freak show stuff. And so in 2011, I watched the film Freaks for the first time at a friend's place. And I was like, yeah, okay, wow, yeah, I need to pursue that pathway and research that more. So I spent a good 3-4 years researching. Then I went to Adelaide Fringe Festival and worked with Space Cowboy and Lizard Man on the circus sideshow. And I found out what a contemporary sideshow grind show was. And then I went to Coney Island and went to the place where Minnie ended up performing. So I took a whole journey to find it, to discover her, to create this show.
That's such an amazing story. Mm. Of course, you mentioned something that I need to ask about. What is a contemporary sideshow grind show?
Yeah. So the freak shows of history used to be places on the side of the main circus attractions. And so they used to tour around with the circus, but be the oddities, be the human curiosities, be the unique and daring acts as well. So you had people swallowing swords and lying on bed of nails and putting nails up their nose. So that historical practice we bring into the contemporary sideshow. There's not many buildings that house sideshow. Coney Island is one of the last remaining ones in the world. That is every day, 7 to 10 shows a day, going over and over the same show, and audiences come in and they go out, and they come in and they go out. And then there's travelling sideshows, which we have here in Australia, which have the same kind of format of short shows, really impactful, push your body to the extreme, please the audience, and then get another audience in.
That term freaks or that you've, you know, talked about, or the idea of a freak show, can be seen as pretty problematic. I mean, I will just own that I find it problematic. Mm. Like, I'm really troubled by the idea of anyone being a freak or that role in history. You've decided to embrace that term, to reclaim it, really. Explain that journey to me.
Yeah, correct. It is a word. Freak is a word that does make people uneasy. And there's a lot of people within lots of different communities who kind of go, wow, how do I relate to this word? Basically, what I think has happened is that the word has become quite negative without really understanding where it's come from historically. So there's a lot of myths around the freak, and the freak showed that it was a really bad place to be, that it was really horrific, that it treated people who looked a bit different really badly. But actually, when you look at the context of the times, when the freak shows rose to popularity, it was around the time that society said, you shall not be out in public. You shall be behind closed doors. You shall be in the asylums all of your life. You shall not work. You shall not go to school. You shall not have children. You shall not marry. So the freak and the freak shows was actually an empowering pathway for people to get out of that quite oppressive situation. And that was legislative. That was the laws said that. So there were ugly laws, anti-marriage laws, compulsory sterilization laws, and all of that was really, really oppressive. So the freak, I'm reclaiming it to actually put the lens back on the truth of the situation, and really clarify what the real story was.
You said you were performing with Sideshow Wonderland, this contemporary sideshow. What was that like? What was your routine?
I loved performing with Sideshow Wonderland. It was great at Adelaide Fringe Festival. And, you know, we did like 12 or more shows a day, I think, from memory. And it was great because I got to test out the character of Cuckoo the Bird Girl. So Cuckoo the Bird Girl wears this funny little fuzzy onesie and this white ostrich feather on her head. And she has these like leather chicken feet shoes. So she looks quite quirky. And so I brought that character to life with this costume, and I brought her to life with dance and with a bed of nails routine. So I brought the skills of Sideshow, like the push your body to the extreme with the bed of nails, because they are quite sharp.
Okay. You really...
I loved it.
You did lay on a bed of nails.
Yeah, I lay on a bed of nails.
Like, and for real?
Yeah, for real. And wow. I'm doing it in this show as well at Melbourne Fringe.
It must kill.
Yeah, it does. I'm pain proof.
How do you get your head around doing that?
A lot of training, a lot of zen. You know, I focus my mind.
You must.
Yeah.
So do you have to go into psychologically, like a whole different headspace to get yourself prepared?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a circus is about pushing yourself to the extreme. It's about seeing what your body can do. So I like Sideshow because it's about seeing what your body can do.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvella. Sarah Hubolt is my guest in the drawing room, and we're talking about her show Cuckoo the Bird Girl. How long do you lay on the bed of nails?
I can lie on it for about 5 minutes, and then I really have to get off.
Ow. Is it good, like, acupuncture as well?
It's poor man's acupuncture. It came from Russia. And when people who didn't have any money really wanted acupuncture, they made themselves a bed of nails.
Okay. Is getting off, now I'm completely obsessed with this. I know I meant to talk about your broader work, but this is
great.
All I care about. Is getting off the hard part, because you're suddenly putting more pressure on certain parts? Yeah.
Getting off is the really hard part.
Which bit hurts the most?
It hurts when you're not focused. So it's all about... Okay, you're going to love this, actually.
Yeah.
So it's all about being very slow and delicate on the bed of nails, because it's about distribution of weight. It's quite scientific. But what I do is that I do hula hooping and angle grinding on the bed of nails, so I shake that up a little bit. So it's a little bit different.
God, you just can't do things by halves, can you?
No, I have to go all the way.
I can't believe you just... Okay, I've just got to get a grip back in the drawing room. Getting a grip, audience, listeners, getting a grip. I'm okay. You said before that you began training at Volcana in Brisbane, but what brought you to circus and the arts? Because you're an elite athlete before that. You know, you just haven't really wasted any time in your life. Why cross over?
No, as soon as I was 5 years old, I started my first swimming competition. I did a little athletics before then, and then I did swimming. Then I spent my whole lifetime, my early years doing swimming, doing the Paralympics when I was around 19. Then I decided I really wanted to do something with the same physicality but with creativity intertwined. So I found competitive swimming just that competitive, and I wanted to do something cooperative. So at the time I thought, hey, maybe I'd swap the chin-up bar for a trapeze bar because it's the same muscularity. So I joined the circus as a result.
Is there accessibility in the arts? You're partially sighted, working in theatre, in circus. How much thought is given to making those spaces, you know, broadly accessible?
That's a very good question. We're getting there with accessibility in the arts, but we're not fully there yet. So I'm of the generation where I'm seeing changes. The generation before me had a lot more barriers in terms of access in the arts. There were amazing people that were performers, but they pushed and pushed to have that happen. So I'm in that generation where people are starting to be aware that, hey, I might have to be taught a little bit differently. I might need more verbal instructions instead of just showing moves and choreography visually. We might have to do something to our theatres if we want performers with disability to actually be on stage. So we're in this awakening period when it comes to accessibility. And we still need to do a lot more, and we still need to make sure that we can perform and do any kind of art form that we want to, but we're on our way.
How much of your time then has to be spent in the sort of activist space, just pushing and pushing and pushing?
90%.
Yeah. I had a hunch. I was hoping it would be lower, but I had a hunch.
I know, it's still 90% of my time still has to be advocate and educator. And it is, it's a headache, to be honest. And so I'm hoping that as every year goes by, it's 80%, it's 70%, it's 60% of my time, because really I want my primary role to be performer.
Yeah, and it should be. How about discrimination? You mentioned before, you know, wanting roles when you're working on your career that you couldn't get. Was there overt discrimination, or just, you know, you just knew that that was the reason?
There's both direct and indirect discrimination. So if I'm going for a role, I need my audition process to be accessible. I need to be able to get to the building in the first place. I need to be able to read the script so that I can learn my lines to be able to audition. So if those things are not accessible in the first place, that is discrimination. And then there's indirect kind of stuff of going, oh, maybe she's not quite right for the role. How are we going to deal with her if she does get cast? That kind of thing. And then there's creative thought around who should play that role. So that's that extra layer of going, there is actually no problem for a disabled person or person with disability to play a mother, a doctor, a boss, a nurse, any kind of role that doesn't specifically say that it has to be attached to disability. Then the other thing that we've got in the arts is that we have a lot of people without disability playing roles of characters with disability. And that's akin to blackface. So that's something that we're advocating that that's not okay, and then we should stop doing that.
Okay, so that's, yeah, I've had other guests in the drawing room who've raised this, the idea that, you know, there are so few roles, why would you give some of these roles? Is that an interim measure, or do you think that as you increase generally, you know, numbers of people with disabilities in the arts, or is that something you think, you know, should be a permanent feature?
We're past that interim stage. We've already reached that critical mass. We have massively successful professional performers around the globe, and they're all attached to agents, or they've all got their profiles on websites. So there is absolutely no excuse for a casting agent to not find them.
How does theatre and circus performance compare to elite sport in terms of dealing with disability and discrimination?
From a physicality level, they're kind of the same. We're offering the same kind of abilities and skills. From an organisational perspective, I think the sports are a little bit more advanced in terms of attitudes and opportunities. I remember doing the Paralympics and everything was organised. We'd be at accessible hotels. We'd have accessible venues to be able to get to our game, our competitions. So in that sense, it's a little bit better set up. However, it's still quite segregated. You've still got the Olympics and the Paralympics as separate events. So in the arts, we might have less physical and information access, but we are a little bit more amongst it.
What sort of lessons are there for the world beyond the arts in accessibility? Because away from the stage, you work at a university, which is a very different environment, I imagine.
Mm. The lesson from the arts is to be a creative thinker and a creative problem solver. So what's really exciting about access in the arts is that we're all creative people, and so we can find lateral solutions to things, and we can have those conflicting conversations and work through it. That's what really excites me about access in the arts, is that it's actually totally possible. Whereas in large organisations and large structures that are bound by a large workforce and having to adhere to certain policy and procedures, it's a little bit more slow going. It's a little bit more like you come across a barrier after barrier after barrier, particularly as places like universities, for example, have a lot of digital platforms which become less and less accessible to a whole range of people if they're not carefully constructed. We don't have those kind of things in the arts as to that extent.
Going back to your performance career, what's your favourite or most memorable show so far? I know it's going to be hard to, you know, really beat the bed of nails for me, but you can try.
No, I'm pretty proud actually of being part of Cirque du Soleil. I did a film, Worlds Away, and I think if a big company, and you know, Cirque du Soleil is a mass product. It is something that's made and it tours around the world as is. So it's a business. And so I'm pretty proud that a company like Cirque du Soleil said, yes, we're going to put you in one of our movies. And that's a good role model for other films, other companies to kind of go, oh, well, they've done it. It's fine for us to do it too.
So does, in that sense, I suppose, Sarah, it's the most important question. Do you see yourself as a trailblazer or as playing that role, leading the way, making it easy for the people behind you who come after you?
I think that will innately happen. I know that there are people who have gone before me, though, as well. Like, there are several sideshow performers and disabled artists in the UK and in America that have also done the freak show stuff and pushed the boundaries. So I know I want to honour the people who have gone before me, but absolutely I'm in that place where I know that there's people coming after me as well, and I know that what I'm doing is inspiring them and opening doors for them. And so that's what being part of a community is about.
So, final question. Cuckoo the Bird Girl.
Mm.
Just give me a sense of the kind of stuff we get to see on stage for this show.
Well, you've got that bed of nails in there.
Yeah, that's it. I'm in.
Yeah, so Cuckoo the Bird Girl is a bit of circus sideshow. It's a bit of dance, but it's a narrative around a mysterious woman from the past who was in a film that was banned. So we see a little bit of Minnie's story. We see Cuckoo really shining, and we see a bit of how Sarah relates to this story. You will see the bed of nails. You'll see hula hooping. You'll see angle grinding. You'll see multimedia projection in a tight little 50-minute show.
And you don't even, I love that tight little 50-minute show. You even get how time poor people are. Sarah, you're excellent. I'm completely taken by you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Hubbolt has been my guest in the drawing room, and her show Cuckoo the Bird Girl is running at the Northcote Town Hall in Melbourne until September 27. If you're not in Melbourne, make your way to Melbourne.